Our reliance on fossil fuels is increasing exposure to carcinogens from the beginning, from extraction, processing, then we burn it, and that's the one we usually see with PM2.5. And then waste. You think about fracking waste or coal ash ponds, the waste from coal burning power plants. So all of those are releasing carcinogens in the surrounding communities, that's worsening cancer risk and cancer outcomes.
Welcome to the Oncology Insights Podcast, a weekly show where you'll find cutting-edge insights and everything that's working at the forefront of oncology.
Welcome to the Oncology Insights Podcast. My name is Abby Beignot. I am a pulmonologist, a physician, an interventional pulmonologist at the University of Minnesota. And we are excited today to be talking with two experts in the field of climate change and thoracic oncology. We have Dr. Joan Schiller, who is an accomplished thoracic oncologist who's conducted many important clinical trials in lung cancer treatment. She has been honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer and recognized for her outstanding mentorship. Dr. Schiller has also founded Free to Breathe, a national advocacy organization aimed at raising awareness and funding for lung cancer, which has since merged with the Lung Cancer Research Foundation. And Dr. Schiller serves on the board of the Lung Cancer Research Foundation. Dr. Schiller is also the chair of the steering committee for the Oncology Advocates United for Climate and Health International. And we're also excited to be joined by Dr. Leticia Noguera, who is the Scientific Director of Health Services Research at the American Cancer Society and an adjunct professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory. Dr. Noguera has also represented the American Cancer Society on the Medical Society Consortium of Climate Change and Health. Thank you both for joining us today. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to meet you.
Today, we're here to talk about climate change and cancer. I would like both of you to get started by giving me a little bit of a history of how did you find yourself in this place scientifically and from an advocacy perspective. Dr. Schiller, why don't you start?
We have a cabin in southwest Colorado, 9,500 feet up, very rustic and very beautiful with lots of, you know, it's in the mountains. And I retired, and all of a sudden I had time to look around, you know, and see what was really happening in the world. I took my head out of the sand and realized that there was a lot of dead trees around the cabin, dead spruce trees. And supposedly they were dying because of the spruce beetle, which found it easier to invade. The trees themselves were very weakened, I guess I would say, by drought and heat. And, oh, you know, it's only a matter of time before the cabin goes up. And I was thinking, what can I do? And, you know, I'm not a climate scientist by any stretch of the imagination, but I am an oncologist. And it also occurred to me that oncologists do not take this very seriously at all. Never hear them talk about it. And so with a couple of my colleagues, also now retired, we decided to form OUCH International. And we did that rather than join one of the already existing groups, because, like I said, oncologists were not in the picture at all. Climate change affects cancer and cancer care and incidence and outcomes and treatment. So OUCH International now has about 200 people. Our website is ouchforclimate.org. And I would invite everyone to take a look at the website.
Great. Thank you for sharing. And Dr. Noguera, I believe you said it's okay for us to call you Leticia today. How did you find yourself in this space? You're quite accomplished in the, you know, climate change and cancer space. How did you find yourself here?
Well, I had worked with cancer research for most of my career. I started actually with the molecular component, very much on the biomarkers and personalized medicine. And an unfortunate almost joke that, as you know, early career professionals we had, is that sometimes our mentors would forget that there was a person around the tumor. And so I moved on to looking more at, well, there is a person with a life with bills to pay around that tumor, so we have to take all of it in consideration. And then later on realized that there is a community around that person and a healthcare system around that community. And so I would say that my career kept expanding from the molecular component inside of the to the person, to the community, to the healthcare system. And that's where I was working at the Texas State Health Department when Hurricane Harvey hit. Harvey had the fingerprint of climate change. It was not the first time that a hurricane reached Houston. We were at the state health department, so we were working very closely with the hospitals. All of them thought they were prepared. They had their checklists, but Harvey behaved completely different. And that's when I had this light bulb moment that because of climate change and this storm's frequency and behavior, and storms are just one example, are going to keep changing. You can have the perfect drug that will perfectly attack your tumor, and you can be at the best medical facility and have the best health insurance coverage and have all of your bills paid, and something like Harvey hits. So that's when I realized that climate change is going to change everything about cancer risk, cancer care, cancer outcomes. Hurricane Harvey hit on August 25, 2017. I was working at the Texas State Health Department. On October 1st, I was working climate change and cancer at American Cancer Society.
WiseNetX turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetX.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Yeah, so you both had a similar experience. I think I've probably experienced this myself, where you start out in your training and you're really laser focused. You're looking at one specific thing. And then with time and with life events and with maturity, you start looking up and looking around. I thought that was I love the way you said that, Joan. You're looking around at the world around you and realizing that all of these things that are happening around us affect the patients that we're taking care of, or the tumors that we're trying to destroy, right? And before we go any further, I think it might be helpful to sort of set the context and make sure that we're all on an agreed definition of what is climate change. If you'd like to offer one, you can, or else I'll share the NASA definition of climate change, which is a long-term change in average weather patterns that have come to define, you know, regional and local and global climates. So this is a little different than weather, which is a more of a short-term description of the atmospheric conditions. It's hot today, it's raining, there's a storm coming, something like that. Anything you want to add to that?
I love that definition because a lot of times, you know, I mentioned I worked in Texas and I had to interact with the public. And sometimes people would say, well, hurricanes, storms have been around forever. What are you talking about? And one of the ways I liked, or that worked sometimes, was that weather is your mood. Sometimes it's sunny, sometimes not as much. And climate is your personality, right? So it's more long-term, and she would never do that. And then something happens, a traumatic event, like you lose a child, or you become a prisoner of war, and your personality changes. And then suddenly you start doing things that people would never think you would do before. That is climate change. It's when you think you know what's happening in a place, and then suddenly something hits that is unexpected, and people were unprepared to respond to it.
That's great. I love that analogy. Yes. I grew up in Louisiana, so I'm very familiar with hurricanes, and, you know, most of them are become a hurricane party, but not much of a hurricane. But more and more you hear about the devastation and the damage of hurricanes. So let's just jump in. I mean, can you describe to me some of the different ways that climate events can impact cancer?
I think the most direct connection between climate change and cancer is through air pollution. Now, technically, air pollution is not climate change, but they both come from the same thing, and that is the burning of fossil fuels. In air pollution, there is small, tiny particles known as PM2.5. They get into our lungs, and they can directly cause lung cancer. So the most direct connection between cancer and climate change is that. There's also a whole bunch of other cancers that we think are probably related to climate change. But because the field is so new, I think the evidence is not as robust as mm-hmm. it is around lung cancer. Mm-hmm. Air pollution probably is responsible for 13 to 14% of all lung cancer deaths globally. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of people.
As a lung doctor, that's certainly the area that I think is most obvious, you know, particulate matter in the air and air pollution and people breathing that in. And I want to just amplify what you just said, because we are seeing more and more people who have never smoked cigarettes and who have no identifiable risk factors for lung cancer. But clearly air pollution exposure, which is very hard to measure and hard to quantify, is an important contributor to lung cancer. What are some of the other ways that that climate change can affect cancer, Leticia?
Right. In my experience, and as I was saying, the light bulb moment was in Houston, Texas. And Houston is proud to be the self-proclaimed oil capital of the world. Mm-hmm. So as Harvey hit this city that has a lot of petrochemical infrastructure and, of course, very dependent on cars, this connection between air pollution, the same air pollution that is driving climate change, also increases lung cancer risk. What Dr. Schiller was talking about is very obvious, very apparent. You can see it when the sun sets, right? You can see the pollution over the city. And then you have this other component that our reliance on fossil fuels is increasing exposure to carcinogens from the beginning, from extraction, processing, then we burn it. And that's the one we usually see with PM2.5. And then waste. You think about fracking waste or coal ash ponds, the waste from coal burning power plants. So all of those are releasing carcinogens in the surrounding communities. That's worsening cancer risk and cancer outcomes. Then we have the second component that I was very much hands-on involved in trying to prevent, which is disruptions in access to care. Mm-hmm. One of our very first studies was patients who are undergoing radiation treatment for non-small cell lung cancer, very aggressive disease. If you miss even a couple of days of your treatment, there is an impact on survival. And we saw that when a facility where you were being treated was impacted by a hurricane, there was a disruption in the treatment and a measurable impact on survival. So the second component that I see is through disruptions in access to care. And then the third component is that cancer and cancer treatment have consequences. They have physical consequences, they have psychological consequences, they have financial consequences, especially here in the United States. And together, all of this can increase our vulnerability to climate hazards. So, of course, we have, for example, a study showing patients recovering from lung cancer surgery who are impacted by a wildfire near their house. And there's also a measurable impact on survival. So you can imagine breathing that smoke and being worried about having to evacuate quickly while trying to recover from lung cancer surgery is not ideal. And then it costs about $1,200 for a family of four to evacuate. So when you think about medical costs or maybe changes in your ability to show up at work and get paid, might impact your financial well-being, that in turn impacts your ability to evacuate or stockpile food if you're trying to shelter in place. So all of these combined also impact cancer. So it's cancer risk through these carcinogens that are being released at every single step. Extraction, processing, burning, PM2.5 and lung cancer is the most obvious, strongest example. Then there's disruptions in access to care. Then there's this increased vulnerability among people who have been diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, so we're seeing, climate change changes our environment and increases our exposure to carcinogens and increases the risk of developing cancer. And then we're seeing that these big catastrophic events also really impact people's ability to recover from cancer and to undergo treatment and to also be financially sustaining that. Are there other, I think we all agreed that, you know, air pollution and lung cancer are really important relationships here. Are there other types of cancers that can be attributed to some of these environmental changes or either the catastrophic events or slow environmental changes over time related to climate?
Other cancer where we have more data is breast cancer. Mm-hmm. There have now been several studies looking at the incidence of breast cancer, either due to weather events or more likely air pollution. But again, like I said, all that data is still emerging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other examples would be brain cancer. Mm. So in Canada, they did a study where they looked at people who were living near wildfires. And by near, I mean 20 or 50 kilometers. So that's, you know, kind of still kind of far away, and found a higher incidence of both brain and lung cancer in those people who were exposed to wildfire smoke.
Mm-hmm. This is especially near these petrochemical facilities. So you think there is this long-term exposure that happens when there's a community around this very polluting infrastructure, constantly releasing benzene, formaldehyde, chromium, all of these elements that have already been linked to several different types of cancers, but you're getting them all at once. And there are several documented cancer clusters that happen around these facilities, especially among children, because if you think about it, children are more likely to get exposed. I don't know if you have a specimen at home. I have a few. They roll into very disgusting things and then put their hands in their mouth. It's really a thing to watch. And of course, their bodies are developing, so they have several relevant windows of exposure. And of course, pound for pound, children breathe more air, drink more water, eat more food. So their levels of exposure are much higher. So you have all of these documented clusters, especially among pediatric cancer, around these petrochemical or even coal mining processing facilities. And then you think about it when there's this baseline, almost constant long-term exposure to these chemicals, and then something like Hurricane Harvey hits or Hurricane Helene. And then those facilities flood, and all of those chemicals are now spread out. And then so you have suddenly this acute exposure, which can also impact cancer outcomes. And so, you know, cancer is not one disease. It's several different diseases, and there are so many contaminants that impact cancer risk. And we're just now trying to look at these from the lens of fossil fuels and climate change. And the more we look, the more we find.
Mm-hmm. Or I was just going to say that another piece of evidence is the fact that we're starting to see cancer in younger people, mm-hmm. young women who have never smoked. That incidence is going up, and that's, you know, a tragic thing. Colon cancer as well. We're starting to see more young colon cancer patients.
Yeah, I think there, I mean, it's, to my knowledge, and you may be more familiar with it, but to my knowledge, you know, the studies that are giving sort of causal or correlational evidence for lung cancer and particulate matter in the air and pollution, there are several for sure, and it makes sense from a mechanism perspective. But some of the other links to other types of cancers and other types of environmental hazards seem to be a bit, you know, looser, right? Is that right? I mean, things that we just don't quite understand yet. You know, there's a lot of talk about younger cancers and increasing incidence of, you know, gastrointestinal cancers and lung cancer in people who never smoked. And is that a lot of that we're still trying to understand, right?
First of all, it takes a long time to develop cancer for most people. So that's why the data is slow in coming out. And it's very hard to point a finger at one person and say your cancer was caused by air pollution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
these are all case control studies primarily, in which they take, they compare people who've been exposed to air pollution or exposed to fires or waste or whatever, and compare them to a group of people that have not. And what they come up with is something called excess death. Because again, you cannot point a finger at any specific person and say that person's cancer. So they're looking. So they're always comparing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is now finally we're starting to get more detailed information about how exactly PM25 causes cancer. Mm-hmm. Up to this point, it was like you said, all casual associations, but now we're developing mouse models, for example, mm-hmm. and real mechanistic basic science to prove it as well.
The International Agency on Research on Cancer, the IARC, is the gold standard for determining that any one compound and substance causes any one type of cancer. And some of the ones we are talking about have been established by both cohort studies, case control studies, basic science, animal models, PM2.5 in lung cancer is an established one. So I think there's also a component of reductionist science versus systems thinking. And so if you try to say this one person throughout their life breathed this amount of PM2.5 and got this one cancer, and you can look at the pathways mechanistic, which, as I was mentioning, is how I started my career in cancer research. That's one thing. And then the other component is to think you have all of these elements separately associated with all of these different cancers. And then we measure what's being released at these facilities and what the nearby community biomarkers tell us that they've been exposed to. So you can call it nascent, or you can call it a more big picture look at these associations that are well established with basic science, mechanistic studies, animal models. And then you put a systems thinking or a big picture lens on these components. And then a different picture emerges. And if you're trying to look at this one tumor inside this one person and their previous exposure. And so that's another way to think, especially for something like climate change. If you're talking about cigarette smoking, it is one exposure, most of it. We did try to break it down into different components, but we know that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer. And with climate change, there's so many different things. And especially as Dr. Schiller was saying, if we look at what is causing climate change, which is also causing lung cancer, that's really where the most exciting solutions are as well. Because if you tackle the cause, you can help solve both.
Right. Then that brings me to, the question of, what can we do to respond? I'm going to quote you to yourself, Leticia. You said, climate change is not a future threat. It's impacting cancer outcomes today. And there are things we can do to respond. What can we do to respond? Help us solve this problem.
So one thing I learned, and now, of course, the name is escaping me. I didn't come up with this sentence, but there are three things we can do about climate change. Mitigation, adaptation, or suffering. The more mitigation we do, the less adaptation will be necessary, and the less suffering there will be. So starting with mitigation, of course, human activities are causing both climate change and worse cancer outcomes. So if we look at ways from our own actions, from the actions of our institutions, from the policies around us, that we can reduce the emission of these pollutants or our reliance on these types of fuels that we know are not good for us. It's not good for anybody really living near the facility or far away. That is the most obvious one. And now that I'll let Dr. Schiller talk more about, especially the oncologist's role in this. The second component is adaptation. So we know that these climate-driven disasters or these events, you can think Hurricane Helene reaching Asheville, which is far away from the coast and in a mountainous region. Nobody ever thought a hurricane was going to get there and how unprepared the community was. So the better prepared we are, the better we will do. So trying to think about research or coalitions or collaborative ways to share lessons learned so we don't have to keep reinventing the wheel or making the same mistake every time another facility is hit by one of these disasters that is behaving differently. And third, there's suffering. We don't want to contribute to that. But suffering, as you were saying, is already happening. Climate change is already here. So the more that we recognize that some of these increases in cancer risk and worse outcomes in this community, in that community, are related to climate change, and we increase awareness of this issue, we measure the suffering, right? And we document it in a way that informs these solutions that I think we're also contributing.
So I would say that what Leticia said was a wonderful 20,000 foot look at this. Mm-hmm. If you narrow it down a bit, there are things that individuals can do. Obviously, one of the most obvious one is to use clean energy and not use so much fossil fuel. And that means, more walking, more bikes, more buses rather than driving. Mm-hmm. That's an obvious one. Or use clean energy in your house, mm-hmm. solar panels, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing that individuals can do is advocacy. Writing or calling your specific legislator or congressman or senator. There is a rule called the 3.5% rule. Have you ever heard of this? Supposedly, it takes only 3.5% of a population to get actively involved. And it's at that point that our policymakers start to really listen. So that's not many people. So if anybody interested in this field, you know, advocate. And you can do that by, like I said, writing or calling. You can do that by supporting one of the nonprofits, since they have more time and they are dedicated full time to this particular cause. And another thing is that we haven't talked about yet is the impact of our health systems on climate change. So our health systems represent about 10% of the carbon footprint. And we need to start doing something about that. And we need to start telling our administrators that, you know, they have to cut back on waste. They have to use a different type of anesthesia because some of them are very potent carcinogens, things like that.
I love this part, too, of reducing the emissions from the healthcare system, because a lot of the times the actions that would reduce emissions also improve health. So, for example, Dr. Andrew Hento has a really interesting study that was published recently about decentralizing clinical trials, where you give option for the patients to interact with a healthcare professional closer to home. That, of course, reduces emissions associated with travel. It improves the patient's overall experience because it also diminishes financial and time toxicity, the amount of time and money that you have to invest to be participating in these. And so it's another one of those, where it's a win-win-win almost, because it makes it easier for people to participate in a clinical trial. It reduces their emissions and improves health outcomes. Similarly, as Dr. Shiller was saying, reducing waste, there is another study that shows how simple changes in the OR made it less likely that waste that was not biohazard waste was placed in the biohazard bin, just because that was the closest one. So they moved it a little bit farther away, and that reduced, it was a measure impact in the amount of waste that was generated. And as we know, that type of waste, when it's processed, it might need to be used ethylene oxide and some other very pollutant, very health detrimental chemicals. And so anything that we can do, everything counts here. It's totally fine to cherry pick, right? If it is transportation or telehealth and or waste, and sometimes even the food that is served at the facility, everything counts. I think every situation here, especially those right at the intersection of climate and health, have great potential.
I was just going to add on another thing that counts is pharmaceuticals, drugs, because they also contribute a fairly large part to the health system impact in general. And so people are starting to do something called life cycle analysis, which means they estimate the amount of carbon that is released from the factory, from transportation to the hospital, and the wrapping, the plastic or whatever, and look at it from a long-term aspect and trying to find out where in that life cycle we can cut back.
I'd like to circle back to a couple of the things that you mentioned. First, Leticia, this is new information to me. I suppose I could have figured out if I thought about it hard enough, but I can't say that I have, which is, so disposing of biohazard waste has a different process than disposing of just sort of inert wrapping paper from sterile equipment, you're saying. And so overuse of biohazard waste. Can you talk more about the biohazard waste processing? I'm not too familiar with what that entails.
Right. Also not my area of expertise. It's not exactly what I work on, but we do have studies showing where this medical waste is processed and the type of chemicals that are used to appropriately dispose of this type of contaminated waste. And ethylene oxide is one of them, very energy intensive process and really horrible health consequences for both people who are exposed within the facilities, the workers, occupational, and also for the surrounding communities. Because you mentioned wrappers, there's another one that might be even easier to think about, which is single-use plastic. Jody Sherman has several publications showing and increasing awareness of how there is no scientific evidence that disposables are better at preventing infections than reusables. We have the process for autoclaving and some other many things, many technologies to be able to reuse equipment without having to dispose. And so this shift towards fewer single-use plastic within a healthcare system and more of these reusables, of course, if you look at the plastic life cycle from extraction, you know, processing, recycle is a lie. I hope you now know that nothing really is getting recycled. It is horrible for the planet. It's horrible for the people who are around these facilities. And when there is a shock to the system, such as when COVID hit, and there is a supply chain disruption, if you are not as reliant on this stream of incoming single-use plastic, you're also more resilient to these disruptions.
Yes, the waste in the operating room for single-use, you know, packages for all sorts of equipment is really, really mind-boggling. I have to sort of make a conscious effort to try not to think about it when I'm in the moment, to not get distracted from, you know, what I'm trying to do there. And you, as you mentioned, supply chain, of course, I'm thinking about how my hospital switched from disposable gowns to reusable gowns during COVID and has primarily stuck with a lot of reusable gowns. So that seems good. The other thing I read in some of the work that you've done is about supply chain disruptions like the IV fluid shortage in Puerto Rico, which again was sort of a weather climate related event that impacted cancer care for people all over the country because they were unable to, you know, get the infusion medications.
And it happened again with Helene in the Carolinas. I think it was a Baxter facility that got impacted, and there was not as bad as the one in Puerto Rico. But we can imagine that as these disasters or these extreme weather events, whatever you want to call it, keep hitting communities that are not prepared, that didn't see it coming, because it is very hard with climate change to predict this. These types of disruptions are going to keep happening.
We talked about a little bit about adaptations to climate change to, you know, mitigate suffering. And you mentioned decentralizing cancer care and clinical trials, which is great. I think, like you said, it reduces transportation and pollution and cost and time toxicity to patients. Are there other sorts of adaptations that you're aware of in cancer treatment facilities to mitigate the impact of climate-related events on the patients that they're caring for?
There are a few that I've heard about. So we now have, you know, diagnosis code, procedure codes that we can use to identify the patients that would be more vulnerable to the types of hazards that come with different disasters. So for example, if you have a diagnosis code for lung cancer or a procedure code for lung cancer surgery, and you know that there's a wildfire moving in your direction, there are ways that you could communicate with the patient and tell about these hazards. In some states, there are these special needs shelters that you can pre-register patients to. So these are shelters that have medical staff on site and an alternative energy source in case you need to plug in your oxygen tank or anything like that. We know that, for example, people who are on sometimes their chemotherapy drugs might have a harder time regulating their body temperature. So even during the summer, you don't need to wait for the heat wave. We already know, we're all tired of hearing that today is the hottest day, right? the hottest August. So you can be proactive in these types of communication and adaptation strategies, both for the patients and also for staff to know that I know, especially doctors tend to think that we're invincible, but we also can be impacted by these and our family can be impacted. And so to be looping this in this emergency preparedness plan so that you have a support from a place to stay to Houston, for example, now offers a childcare service during disaster so that the physicians that have a family can stay within the hospital with their family and continue to provide care during disasters.
The other thing I think that we need to get the word out for is how the patient themselves can prepare. And like having a kit at home that's going to have such things as their hospital records, a list of their medications. One study asked patients who were escaping a disaster, what were the biggest impacts? And the first was dentistry, of all things, not being able to see a dentist. But the second thing was only about half of the population actually brought along any records, medical records or medications, or they didn't know the names of those. So that's obviously very, very important.
That's a plug for, I guess, a patient portal or some way to be able to access all of your records kind of remotely and electronically. I'm thinking about myself if I were trying to evacuate my home and all the things I'd be trying to grab. And, medical records might not be the first thing on my mind for sure. But I suppose if you're actively undergoing a serious medical condition, you might be. You know, you bring this up and I'm thinking, gosh, we don't I have no experience with healthcare organizations that take a systematic approach to anticipating climate events or weather disasters. As a lung doctor, we sort of can tell in the clinic when the air quality is bad because our patients are feeling it. Right, they're calling in and saying, "I'm having an exacerbation of my chronic obstructive lung disease. I'm struggling. I'm wheezing. I'm having these problems," and so we can kind of feel in the vibes in the clinic that things are not going well out in the world, but wouldn't it be better for us to try to anticipate what was coming and share this information with our patients? I'm going to make a plug for one of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Erica Moseson, who is also a pulmonologist, who has a podcast called Air Health, Our Health, where she talks about really practical strategies like this, about a kit for air quality days and how to make your own HEPA filter if you know you're going to have a bad air quality day, and ways to cope with these things as individual people who are already dealing with chronic medical illness. So I guess my questions at this point are, is there anything else that we haven't covered today that you think is really important to discuss on this topic?
I think Leticia brought it up about the effect of climate change on medications. Many of our drugs cause sun sensitivity, and, people are going to be exposed to more sun, or dehydration, diuretics, and some chemotherapies. People might not be able to keep up. And then, of course, as she mentioned, it has the heat has impacts on how we metabolize the drugs. It does impact how we metabolize the drugs and how stable the drugs are. So if they're not stored properly because of the heat, they're going to go bad. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
So metabolism inside the body in the heat event, and then also storage in a medical facility are both impacted by heat. Yeah. So if they lose power, a colleague of mine was telling me about, she was in Kansas a while back, they were having this heat dome, and she said, "My clinic lost power." And, it was 90 degrees in the clinic. So that's not good for the medications and things that they're storing there, not to mention their patients.
We sometimes think a lot on long term, but as we were saying, a lot of the impacts are already here. And preparedness really is the easiest way to start thinking about this, right? What's your emergency power source, for example? And so the more we start seeing things that are already happening in this light and talking to our colleagues about it. So you said that there's this vibe in the clinic. If we were able to measure exacerbation of symptoms and how much does that cost, or how much does that influence outcomes, would we be able to come up with an intervention or to be better prepared to better protect or take care of patients, or to diminish the disruptions that we're having due to power outages or supply chain disruptions? How can we start adding this lens of climate change to pretty much every single thing that we do? Is something.
Mm-hmm. There was a study done, Leticia, I think you know about this, about cancer centers and what type of emergency preparedness plans they have. And it was under 5% of cancer centers had a plan.
I'm curious if that was done several years back or since COVID, do you know? Because I would think maybe they would have them now if they didn't then, but you might be surprised.
I suspect that they're relying on the health system's plans in general, mm-hmm. probably.
Yes, yes.
Because yeah. Mm-hmm. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services already requires healthcare facilities to have an emergency preparedness plan, and they have some guidelines. But they don't require that these plans are shared with CMS or with each other, like with different facilities. So we don't know how well I work, what works in this scenario, but not in that one. So I think that as we come together and start thinking along these lines, then we are probably going to be better able to learn from previous experiences and then continuously do better instead of having to reinvent the wheel and experience power outage after power outage and things along those lines.
Yeah, and the needs of individual patients are going to vary, right? A very meager emergency preparedness plan might be suitable for people who are relatively healthy and, you know, they don't lose their power, they have backup medications, or they're not undergoing, actively undergoing treatment for a serious health condition like cancer. One of my, I'm going to give myself a call to action here. One of the ideas that I have been tossing around in my home where we live, we're near a trail. And so lots of people like to walk and bike on this trail. And there have been times where I look out my window and I see people walking, running, biking by, and you know, it's a bad air quality day. I live here in Minnesota. We've had some, air quality, issues with Canadian wildfires and unhealthy air quality days. And I'm like, those people should not be out there biking. They should not be out there running. You know, I think the more that we make this lung cancer and air pollution connection known, this also has the advantage of potentially destigmatizing lung cancer. I know, Dr. Schiller, I'm sure you've experienced that people who are dealing with lung cancer also have to deal with an unfair stigma around lung cancer because many people assume it's due to cigarette smoking and that they sort of made a behavioral choice. And increasingly, that is less and less true and relevant. And so I personally like to make this link between air pollution and air quality and lung cancer, because not only to help people prevent it, to make sure that they're aware of it and take care of themselves, even if they're healthy and athletic, but also to destigmatize lung cancer. So I told my husband, I said, I'm going to have a little sign made for the yard that's just like kind of a public service announcement that says, hey, you know, it's a bad air quality day. You might want to rethink your outdoor activities with maybe like a QR code to a website. He's like, oh gosh, don't be that lady. But after this conversation today, I might have to just go ahead and be that lady in the neighborhood. Well, I think I will try to get some of the studies that you referenced in the show notes, if that's an option. I hope so. And so if you would share any of the ones that you mentioned, especially some of those ones about the healthcare waste, the biohazard, if you know anything about that, and the single-use disposables, so that we can share those references for our listeners. And if there's nothing else to add, I'll say thank you very much for your time today. Nice to meet you, Dr. Nogueira, and nice to see you again, Dr. Schiller. And I really appreciate your time bringing important awareness to this area. And I want to remind all of our listeners to subscribe to the podcast. This is produced by Wisenetics, and this should be available anywhere that you can get a podcast. So subscribe so you don't miss the next episode.
Thank you again for having us. Really, it's an important topic, and it's more people that know about it, the better.
I'm so glad you both started looking up at the world around you and are trying to make a meaningful impact on all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.